Met a ghost of a king on the road when I first fell. Fire burning to my knees, I fell. Met a ghost of a king on the road.
So we're here.
Here we are.
It's SASS. And for my daughter's sake, I should say, I already forgot the episode number. So
we're back to usual.
So no joke. I'm not going to joke about it. It's deadly serious, but I forgot it.
I know. Yep.
Is it 147?
I don't think we know.
But it's a serious, serious thing, and I won't yeah. jest.
There's just for there's Lucia's, no joking about
for Lucia's
it.
For Lucia's sake, I will not jest about it.
Let's see. Did you catch the eclipse today?
Depends on what you mean by catch.
It got dark outside. But
I looked
tell
in a box, and it was vague.
Yeah. Nice. I just saw clouds, and I thought it was dark. Right. The clouds.
Yes. No, I did not. I missed the apocalypse today.
Yeah.
I missed it. So what are we talking about today?
Today,
Brian Cole, while I text my son, in a podcast.
Speaking of sons and other children, we're talking about pain and suffering, especially as a parent, and how...
Didn't we just do this with Shawshank?
No, I think Shawshank's takeaway was the hammer. Sure, you got to grind through the pain, but the little, you got to find the hammer in the situation.
We can talk a little bit about pain.
I think this one probably allows you to get into your current track wheelhouse where parents, I feel like we're very comfortable.
Oh, yes.
A comfortable culture.
Yep.
And actually very not ready. When things go badly, we're quick to just quit. Like, the more I read, I was reading, I just finished Master and Commander, whatever the book one is. It is Master and Commander. So the O'Brien series with Aubrey and Maturin, which was awesome.
The ship series.
Yes. Lots of boat stuff that I looked up. And just realizing how comfortable we are with being comfortable.
Yeah.
And I think when we find the discomfort, that's kind of my question. How much do we push as both parents and Christians to find the discomfort? There's a certain ascetic tendency that loves it, really loves to lean into the discomfort. But that doesn't seem to be most people.
Yeah. And I think that's the wrong tendency.
So the sit on a pole tendency is...
Well, put it this way. The entire point and the benefit of suffering and pain when you're working for something is that you don't like it. So for people who have the kind of personality, the defective personality that likes that, it's not that, they're more virtuous, or they're tougher or stronger or anything like that. They might be tougher in a particular task because of their weird wiring.
Yeah.
But if they get the same pleasure response out of running 5 miles that you get out of eating a bag of Doritos, that's not like gold star to them for running 5 miles. They went and followed their impulses. Sure. They didn't discipline their impulses towards the good, for the sake of the good. They didn't do that. They did it because they like it. And somebody who's doing it because they like it is not getting some virtue award. Now, at the same time, is it better to like hard work than to like a bag of Doritos? Yeah, it is. It's so there's another layer where it's like, yeah, that's an advantage. Should you train yourself to be joyful while running, suffering, working? Yeah, you should. But you're not doing it for your own pleasure. So there are gym rats who are just addicts.
Yeah.
It's just a different kind of addictive personality, and they're doing it because they can't control their impulses, just like somebody else is a porn addict or an alcoholic. And there are people doing that. And it's while their vice of choice is not as incredibly destructive as some others, it still can be. And it's not like automatically holy.
Yeah.
Just because it involves more caloric burn.
Right.
More lactic acid, not necessarily better.
Nice. Second question to that, I think we have some specific questions about fear from Timothy, who's listening to this. So Timothy is wondering specifically about fear and your children and books and stories. Mm. And so that's slightly different than the pain question, but it does seem like a jumping off point, perhaps. How do you expose your kids to things that are scary in writing? I guess the question perhaps the on-road should be, what do you have any particular memories of very scary stories for your kids? Stories that
for
they
my
struggle.
Children?
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually think that as a rule, Christians just do a terrible job of this.
Oh, in general, not just children.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that they treat each other like children and they treat their children horribly. So they give everybody the child treatment when it comes to content and storytelling and fear. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of horror at all. I think there's something else going on there. I am a fan of some stories that would be considered horror.
Yeah.
But very particular stories, but not the genre of like mm-hmm. slasher movies or things like that. However, I am a big fan of telling your kids the truth.
Yeah.
And I've come back to that over and over and over again. Tell your kids the truth. Now, the knowledge of good and evil can be destructive, but we know where the limitations are. So you're not telling them everything. You know, they walk through the room and you're watching some news story about some horrible serial killer. You don't say, "Hey, Johnny, come here. Let me tell you what this guy did to 47 women." Like, no, you're not going to, you're not doing that. But you should be able to tell them the Bible stories. This is what I come back to over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And if you are hedging the Bible stories, which most Christians do, like most Christians do. I had a conversation with a producer on a project where we're talking about the faith market, and another writer said, "So you're telling me that Christians don't like the Bible and don't want to see the Bible story actually?" And he's like, "That's exactly what I'm telling you. That this market cannot handle that, will not handle that, will react against it." And he could be right or wrong, but I think there's lots of ways in which he's right.
Sure.
So if you tell your kids the story of Noah, if you tell that story honestly, it's quite scary. If you tell the story of the Exodus honestly, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. If you tell the story of Passover honestly, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
The plagues of Egypt, terrifying. Every single household in all the land was going to have a dead son or a dead lamb. One or the other. And you got to pick. Are you going to have the lamb take the son's place? And if so, you better be ready with your blood magic and your blood talisman painting on the door. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a dead son or a dead lamb. There's a river turning to blood here. We have a river turning to blood. Do you know what kind of death and destruction that causes? Yeah. You know, the carcasses and the stench of a river turning to blood. We kind of just duck and dodge all these stories.
Are you?
And so
is that
if
a question
you are,
of
if
stakes?
You're telling, but get, yeah, but get all the way. No, telling it honestly.
Yeah.
Stakes, pain, the story. If you tell the story of the crucifixion honestly, if you are telling the gospel story to your children as you ought to be, there are not things, books that are scarier than that. There are things that are creepier. There's little spiders and there's little creepy things.
Or a jump scene perhaps.
Should you think about this? Are you neutering scripture in order to tell your kids Bible stories? And are you neutering the natural world that God made in order to tell your kids stories? So are you protecting them from whip spiders? Are you protecting them from orb weavers? Are you protecting them from bats? Are you trying to not show them creatures God designed and made and loves?
Yeah.
And you're trying to keep them in the puppies and the kittens space. It's really, really dangerous when a son or daughter, but especially a son, feels that they are this steely-eyed adventurer into the natural world that his mom is too chicken to see. Like that he's actually, you know, she's this buzzkill. She's this anchor around my leg. I'm the one who has to go out here and discover snakes. And, you know, at the same time, I crash hard on parents who are all about their little boys being cruel to animals.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so I find something reality, God made and hurt them.
Right.
You know, the reality is snakes eat mice, and that's a pretty gruesome thing to see as a kid, and you should see it. Mm-hmm. This is just the way, you know, the way it goes. So
I think it's Psalm 104 we were just reading, where part of the praise of God is the fact that he is actually taking the spirit away from animals. You know, it's not that Psalm is like, hey, he's the creator. He makes all the animals out of nothing from Leviathan all the way down. It's like, well, actually, when he turns away, their spirit's gone and they're back to the dust. Like they're dead. That's something too that I think I mentioned when one of my kids was struggling with some nature documentaries. That's something that I think is important for me to lean into. It's not like, oh, this mouse is dying because of the fall, although that's true. It's also like God is in charge of that snake and the ecosystem of mouse and snake and made it. And in some way, that's still good because that's how Psalms talks about it.
Yep.
Which I think, well, I'll have to revisit that with my kids.
But so if you're willing to talk about, you know, the natural world, if you're willing to describe the intricacy and the riot and the dance, the aspect of creation that's groaning and the aspect of creation that glorifies the creator, the glimpses we get of Eden and the glimpses we get of the result of the curse. If you're telling them those stories and you're telling them honestly, then you're telling Bible stories honestly, and you discuss them and not in a gleeful way and not in a totally neutered way, then the kinds of stories they can handle and they can tolerate. It's like, well, just it measures against that. And I think that the ones that you end up avoiding are the ones that are going to be creepy. I've told this story before about my son being haunted by terrible nightmares, night terrors, from the illustrations in the Narnia Chronicles by Pauline Baynes.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
where no parent is like, these are terrifying.
I'm just like, okay, I get you. His imagination is rich. His imagination is strong. And like, he looked at that line art and he saw those ghouls and witches around the stone table. And
yeah,
it just...
There's a real nice full page illustration.
And that one especially just got him. He was maybe four and a half, pushing five. And maybe a little younger than that because we were reading it to him, but it just stuck. I mean, it just really, really stuck.
Lewis has a great description of them all too.
Yeah.
And
that was the story I know I've told here before, where in the middle of the night I made him shoot aliens.
Yeah.
You know, where I downloaded a old combat game, and at 1 a.m. had him pulling the trigger on a shotgun, blasting away monsters. And I was running through this, you know, alien world, and he had the trigger.
Yeah.
So I was steering and he was just boom, 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 like blowing aliens away.
Yeah.
And that moment I thought, this is either a really genius dad solve or this is the worst idea ever. Like this is one of the
other. He's never going to sleep again.
Yeah. It's one or the other. Here we are. He woke up screaming and had these vivid monsters chasing him. And I was like, man, how do I instill in him what you do? And when I put him back to bed, I told him, I was like, okay, so when they come back, just shoot him. Just pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
Just blast him. And he slept like a baby, and we didn't deal with it again. It was like right there. So it worked. It was like, woohoo, big bet. When I told my wife what I'd done, she was like, are you sure? And I was like, nope. Nope. But we're iterating. We're iterating. If it doesn't work, I'll try something else. And with my daughter, my youngest, she was terrified of dragons and serpents, and she was haunted by... It took a while, but it turned out it was cinnamon. If she'd had any cinnamon that day, she had these crazy, crazy, horrible nightmares.
Spice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just serpents everywhere coming for her, dragons coming for her, coming out of the walls. And she had them with her eyes open. She would wake up and they'd still be going. And so with her, it involved telling her the story of the fall and of the war in heaven and of how many. Of, you know, how many were thrown down, how many of the heavenly host. It was not dragons aren't real. It was like, yeah, they are real. There are spiritual dragons. There are these fallen seraphim. But for every bad one, there's two good ones. One third of the host of heaven was thrown down. Two-thirds is faithful. So just so you know, like two good ones for every bad one.
Yeah. Isn't it true?
And just even getting there and starting to push her imagination into the concept of good serpents that were obedient, you know, powerful dragons that were obedient and had not fallen, was big. It was huge. It was all it took.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering how much it does seem like that fear of the unknown is kind of what both cheap horror and also good terror, perhaps, is right on that boundary.
Yeah.
Like when you don't know what the creepy crawly thing is that's running around, I don't know, eating animals on your block. And then when you find it out, often a lot of the terror disappears. It does seem like parents have that ability to contextualize for their kids, this is what's coming and this is what we need. And a little bit of explaining or background goes a long ways for something that's unknown.
Yeah. I'll put it in the narrative, put it in the context, and put it in the narrative where it's supposed to be. But it's also, I mean, Christians this way, the way I think that adult Christians mute and neuter their content, and they take it all the way down to something they can watch with their kids, and they don't really move past that. And like, so it has to be very childish and very immature and not fully enfleshed, not believable, never quite, you know,
yeah,
all the way scary.
I was going to ask you, as far as all the way scary is concerned, the Bible is full of demons and demon possession, especially, which has kind of become this bailiwick of, you know, B-level horror and some A-level stuff too. But my question on that is, yeah, do you have thoughts about that? Jesus fights demons. That's a big part of his ministry is he's chasing them out and claiming them and not allowing them to become the force of the proclamation of the Son of God is here. You know, he's very much, to me, it's just interesting to watch something. And if I think of demon stories, I tend to think of Frank Peretti or the slasher jump scenes.
Or really terrifying horror films.
Right. But Jesus doesn't use demons in that way. They're almost almost like heralds, I guess. It's like a kingdom thing when Jesus is...
They're like the Philistines that Samson kills. You know, it's just like, they're just these enemies that he's just rolling over.
That everybody could not handle.
And it's just like, here's a judge. And he's just rolling through him.
He only needs
a jawbone. You know, it's just, it's not fancy. They're just weak. They're nothing in front of him.
Yeah.
And I think that's very much kind of how they're used. They're used as all these lower witnesses of the authority of Christ. So yeah, they announce his status. They announce his power as he rolls through him.
I was thinking we read Legion, right?
Okay.
Two demon possessed guys. Mark focuses, I think, on one of them on Legion, and you know he's naked, has the chains, he can snap apart, is in the tombs, you know, screaming. And then Jesus comes, and all of a sudden Legion becomes a missionary, which is kind of the first time you get the Philistine flipping into. All of a sudden he is now a witness to the Decapolis, the whole area across the river of here comes something new is here.
Yep.
I think there's
something to that part of Christ's ministry and his selection of the disciples at all, but even the people that he heals or, you know, the battles of healing or demons being driven out. It reminds me of David's mighty men, where very few of them are Jewish.
Mm.
You know, it's like I'm trying to remember how many are Jewish. You know, it's like
obviously I'm only remembering Uriah the Hittite, obviously. Yeah,
but they're coming from all over.
A lot of these were his bandits, right? From the wilderness.
Yeah, but there are these stories of things they did and had accomplished. These guys were something else. I mean, they were something else. These guys are straight out of Homer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of the kinds of things that they had done. These are ancient heroes. And all of them are beta to David, you know, and they come in and they would be the enemies of Israel. These should rightly be the enemies of Israel. And instead they're conquered, they're taken, and they're made David's.
Even better because they're now.
Yeah. And you see that as Christ claims, you know, tax collectors, as he claims Paul. And, you know, as he claims these people, but he's claiming fishermen, he's claiming dummies and hotheads.
Yeah. Rich guys.
Yeah. and it's like in some ways, some of them were enemies. Paul obviously was, but Zacchaeus, you know, all these little enemies and just all these conquests that turned them into his men, his missionaries, his heralds.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that, I think more with David than you see that with any other Old Testament hero or judge.
Yeah.
Obviously Samson's hanging with the Philistines, but David is men from the nations. It's men from the tribes all around who are brought in as heroes from these different, groups and then made good guys.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause they're fighting behind him.
Right. And I guess Jesus telling Legion he doesn't get to come.
Yeah.
Or I guess new guy, you know, I don't, you stay here. That story is always interesting to me with the thousands of pigs, 2,000 pigs, you know, in the water and Legion saying, I'd like to go with you. And Jesus saying, no, stay here. Anyways, but the point of this was that fear of like demon possession. Yeah. How does the Bible handle demon possession? It in one sense, there's not so much mystery as surrounds all of it in horror flicks. Like, yeah. It does seem to me that that's what the horror flick relies on, is this idea of what is it? Is it a demon or is it just a weird person?
I had a friend who was working on a docuseries, but you could call it a reality show or a docuseries, a follow doc, following an exorcist. And he's a writer who's Eastern Orthodox. And so it's this Eastern Orthodox exorcist, and they handle it very differently than the Catholics. The Catholics have a whole thing. And he said it actually was a little difficult. It was a little hard to try to make it good TV because it was so simple. It was just like, if you proclaim the name of Jesus, you win. You know, it's like, it's just, it's like, it's not really complex, big rituals and things. But it's also interesting to me that this is a whole big distraction, that world overwhelmingly thrives and exists in non-Protestant circles. So it's not to say that there aren't issues in the Protestant world. There absolutely are. But it's nowhere near the volume that you see elsewhere.
Well, isn't some of the argument that can be made as the gospel spreads? So take cannibalistic cultures. They're going to have a demon problem.
Yeah.
Because Jesus is new.
I'm talking about in the church.
Oh, you're saying church. Gotcha.
So yes, absolutely. But if you have an established ancient Catholic community, you could still deal with a lot more demonic activity, demonic oppression, demonic possession, and they need an exorcist. Then you would have, if you are in a Presbyterian town.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
Man, I've got my theories. But
is it quicker to claim the name of Jesus? I know that when my kids have been scared and have been like, hey, demons, they're scary, I'll say, yeah, we have Jesus on our side. We pray whenever we want. And also, if it was a monster, we'd kill it. So we have like a twofold thing real fast. Like,
I think
Jesus, I don't need a saint. I don't need a saint to help me with this.
I think actually, I think my own theory and the theory I've argued with friends about is that it has more to do with the concept of personal regeneration, the nature of personal regeneration, and then if somebody in Protestant circles was feeling distant and not possessed by the Holy Spirit and not in a strong personal relationship with Christ, then they would be considered to be not a Christian, right? If you like, it's
okay,
you know, but if you are in a Catholic community and you are
feeling distant,
you have a favorite saint and you're mediating through saints and you're part of the institution and you're going to confession, you can be Catholic and you can be Christian, quote unquote, in that world and be more vulnerable
and perhaps get further from God
and not be possessed by the Holy Ghost, you know. So I think some of it's really interesting, but in terms of discussing it, I think that there's some of my Catholic friends talk about basically the way they talk about sainthood, you know, is the way we talk about being a Christian. Just minus the miracles. So you take this, you know, the miracles away, and there it's really interesting. So there's a lot of conversations. I don't pretend to understand. But I also think that, and this might be the real truth, is that when you have a hammer, more things look like a nail. And so the concept of the position of exorcist and of exorcisms and the formality that exists around that in the Roman Church.
Yeah.
And that formality in the Roman Church, I think, means they see more issues. Now, I think in the Presbyterian Church, especially the Reformed Presbyterian Church, there's an impulse to be far more materialistic and analytical. And so thinking you can intellectually counsel people out of demonic oppression, you know, like,
sure,
you could. And so you have to kind of go to the more charismatic branch of Protestantism before you see them identifying things, and maybe too many things, but identifying things as demonic activity and anointing with oil and praying and, you know, and doing all that kind of stuff, where more Reformed Christian believers are very, very slow
to call something demonic,
to believe in something being demonic. And so I think that's a big part of it. My guess is in the Reformed Presbyterian world, there's more demonic activity than they recognize or they acknowledge.
Sure.
Because they have unbelief and on a really significant level in terms of being materialist. Whereas in the charismatic churches of Protestantism,
way too much.
Well, yeah, more.
Right.
Like just more.
More than there is, yeah.
And I would say that I actually am not, and then the Catholic Church more as well. And I would say that I am not in a position to know who's closest to accurate. I don't know. So if I look at my branch of Christendom, and we have very, 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 very little that we would just put on demons and say that's demonic oppression or possession.
Right.
My charismatic brothers and my charismatic friends would laugh at me.
And they'd point to, if I were there, I would point to all of these illnesses, oppression.
Yeah, cancer.
Yeah, mental stuff. Yeah.
Cancer is really up there for a lot of them. And they go after that with prayer about evil and the curse. And, you know, they really do tackle it in interesting ways. And then the Catholic Church has this formality around the exorcist and exorcism and so on. And in terms of how many demonic things the Catholic Church sees and identifies, how many my charismatic brothers see and identify, and how many we see and identify.
Sure.
I'd be willing to bet that we are not the closest to the truth.
Yeah, because we've talked about how materialist we are.
Yeah. So I don't know who is. Yeah. I don't know if it's the Catholics who identify it the most easily and readily. I don't know if it's the charismatics. I don't know if it's us who was closest to getting the right answer. But I can see the different personality traits of the church. And so that branch of Christendom, the Roman branch of Christendom, has particular approaches to holiness that are different than the Protestant approaches to holiness.
Right.
But the charismatics have very different, and you know, just saying charismatic is a huge tent too. There's a whole spectrum over there. And at some point, I think we'll find out what the right answer is. but I don't think it matters a ton as long as you understand that belonging to Jesus is all you need against them.
Yeah.
Like the name of Christ and belonging to Christ is sufficient protection.
Yeah. If there's a room, you better make sure there's a strong man in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Otherwise. Yeah.
Squatters' rights are a big deal these days.
Yeah.
in the news. So you want to be fully possessed. You want to be inhabited by the Holy Spirit. You want to belong to Christ. And just know that wherever you are in the spectrum of Christendom, belonging to Christ is the most important thing. Like, that's it.
That's what it is.
That's what you should tell your children about. But lying to them about demons, lying to them about their existence, making them comfortable with just a very materialistic world is a deadly thing to do.
Right. I think we've talked about this before, but you've made the claim that the demon stories come on so strong in, say, the 20th century because we lost our supernatural understanding of the world. And we are trying to tickle that sensibility. A lot of modernists are trying to tickle their supernatural sensibility, or what, as Lewis would put it, the discarded image that we've gotten rid of. We're now trying to, when something tickles that image of like, oh yeah, the universe is full of spirits.
Yeah.
We react with fascination now because we've deadened that sense. And that seems to be where a lot of these, you know, watching March Madness and yet another Exorcist movie preview comes on.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that I wouldn't watch a movie about somebody beating a demon. It's just not very exciting. You know, it's like, okay, sure, the demon's the bad guy. We got to get rid of the demon. Yeah. It's a little creepy that a demon could possess.
No, it's creepy.
But
and
it's not.
Some of the true stories, the ones that are based on true stories, are pretty rugged.
The creepiest of all.
Yeah, it's pretty, they're not things I want to watch, you know?
Right. Sure.
Tell me the ending. Do the good guys win?
Right.
Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. I do. It is. I will say this, as long as we're being distracted on this topic, I think there's something with demons in water. Like, they can't swim.
Oh, you think so?
I don't think so. There's something super weird there.
Okay, you're going off of obviously the pigs running into the water.
The pigs, but then also the stories, the, you know, the mythologies around Solomon and Suleiman capturing the jinn, the fallen, you know, the fallen spirits, putting them in lamps, sealing the lamps with the name of God. And so the name of God that is not known to us, the symbol that is like the pictograph, like the name of God on that seal, and throwing them in the sea. And then being safely in sea until fishermen snag one in a net.
Bring it in
and then rub it, trying to see what it is, trying to clean it, trying to polish it, and rub off the name of God and release a genie. All the genie in the lamp stories, all of them originate from the damned, thrown down, rebellious spirits being imprisoned. Sometimes they were imprisoned in rocks. They were imprisoned in various things, but being imprisoned in objects. And they were sometimes imprisoned in stone, unable to get out. And some of them imprisoned in lamps and thrown into the deep pit of the ocean.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and it's really interesting.
We're being very speculative now. We can talk about that. But I was about to speculate.
Okay, go ahead.
If demons are air, that makes sense. If demons are air/fire, then earth, water are going to be, you know, if we're talking elemental spirits, then that
why
not
riff
sense.
On that?
Yeah.
But I've always thought, so this is the kind of thing I do where I'm like, okay, so if Christ puts them in pigs, the pigs are the vehicle of the destruction. They are not the destination. Mm-hmm. They're not the prison. Because the pigs run into the water and die.
Because it has been quite a question, because they say, hey, please don't destroy us. And Jesus said, can we go on the pigs? And Jesus says, sure.
And then sends the pigs.
And then the pigs all go drown.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they're all imprisoned.
Yeah, but it's super weird to be like, so the pigs all died. Mm-hmm. And so are those demons trapped in pig remains at the bottom of the water? Were they sealed permanently in the remains? Or did they get sealed in the water?
Right.
And it's, I don't know. But what I know is that they didn't get released right back to go, you know, just obliterate more people.
Yeah.
You know, Christ defeated them.
Yeah.
And there's a 1-2 punch of they're like, please, 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 please. And he's like, fine. And then there's it's actually a classic ancient story structure there where somebody makes that request but fails to anticipate.
Yeah.
Like,
there's the old myth of the bee asking, can I have my sting be fatal?
Yeah.
And Zeus says, sure, but
also to you.
To you. Yeah.
Yeah. Can my sting be fatal, please? And they fail to add that detail. Right. And that's a very ancient trope. It's a trope that shows up in all the hero stories over and over and over again, where somebody like asks the gods or whatever and gets their request, but gets it with just having left this little bit of room, this wiggle room where they get just exploited.
Right.
And in that dialogue, in that story, I think that's absolutely what happens.
Because I think people wonder. They think,
please don't destroy us. Can we go on the pigs? And he says, sure. And then, but the pigs are going into the sea. He doesn't throw them into the sea directly.
Yeah. It's fascinating too.
So that's my theory. My theory is water is a thing.
Interesting.
For them.
I mean, also too, the pigs, you know, those folks working on it were in a somewhat more Gentile region, but also would have been Jews raising pigs for the Romans, which is an interesting factor as well of Jesus, you know, blowing up a very rich economy.
Very lucrative.
Yeah, lucrative way.
That's a lot of pigs to just be like, and no mas.
Yeah.
It's also, I would say, as part of this, in terms of, I come back to tell the Bible stories over and over and over again. Do it, do it, do it, do it, do it for real. One of the things that, and I already mentioned this in terms of like gym rats who congratulate themselves on doing something more virtuous than the guy who's addicted to food, but they're both just addicted to a habit and it's not actually virtue, it's just impulse. Their impulses are not as destructive or not as bad, but they're both just submitting to impulse. in the Bible stories, one of the things we need to get better at is understanding nature of temptation and gift. And so, like, gifts, talents, we look at David, and it's easy for people to feel superior to David because they have not committed adultery. Like, they have not murdered.
Mm-hmm.
But the simple fact is they couldn't. So
they were not the king of Israel.
They don't have the wife of a warrior, of a great hero trying to seduce them.
That's a trigger warning, Nate.
But even there, let's go ahead and use a different narrative interpretation. They don't have the beautiful wife of a heroic warrior available to them at all.
Right.
They do not have the ability to take the wife of another, let alone to take the wife of another and murder her husband. They don't have that in their range of capacity. And so they don't really get any kind of congratulations for not doing that.
Okay.
It's like,
at first wondering where you're going with this, but you're just saying that great responsibility.
Yeah. So Moses gets judged, right? The amount of power and communion with God that Moses had was so much that when he struck the rock, he was sinning against incredible light. And so, you know,
almost Adam Adamic.
It was pretty big. It was big enough to keep him out of the promised land, you know? Yeah. And obviously he was a great hero, but the standard was very, very high. Samson, my point here is people are so judgy. They're so judgy of Samson. But like, I look at a guy and like I think, like, what are your impulses and how well are you resisting them? Like in your narrative.
I think that's a better way of explaining that question, because a lot of kids say, hey, why did Adam eat the fruit? If I was there, I wouldn't have eaten the fruit, right?
Sure.
That's kind of the conversation parents say, where they're like, no, you do. You eat the fruit in your own life
all the time.
You just haven't had the chance to ruin it for all your descendants, because that's already been ruined.
Oh, you can make it worse though.
Yeah.
But it's in all these stories, and especially stories of fear, we weirdly congratulate ourselves or passing tests we've never taken and never will take.
Mm.
And we constantly fail the tests we are given. And it's amazing to me how often people congratulate themselves for being brave or courageous or not scared. And they measure that by their ability to tolerate some horrible type of movie. Like they love slasher movies. They watch it and they think they're very courageous. But they've never gone out the front door and done something truly hard that scared them ever. You know, it's like they have something that is their vice and scares other people, but they're not tempted to be scared by it. But they're not actually out there challenging their own fear. And I think that's David was scared of virtually nothing. I mean, he was just scared of virtually nothing. And yet you see in the Psalms that he still got up to his threshold for fear and terror, you know, and total lamentation. So you see that he got pushed all the way there, but he wasn't scared when he went to face Goliath. He wasn't scared, you know, just marching through, but he got there. Like he got there in the end. And we are, let's just put it this way. I don't get to congratulate myself for not being a world conqueror who just exploited and destroyed whole nations and peoples like Alexander the Great. You know, it's like, I don't get to say, well, at least I didn't conquer the world like Alexander.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't, I don't have that ability. If I had that on the table as one of my options, would I resist the temptation to do it? I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny. Like people have their abilities and they have their temptation range, and we give into our own temptations and we give into our own fears.
Sure.
And so we are scared of making particular moves. Particular moves make us nervous. Sure. And so we come up against our own nervousness and then we capitulate. Sure. And we find some.
Are you a dad who never bets anything? Just constantly anteing.
Yeah.
You know,
de-risking and being cautious.
Yeah.
And you're comfortable with those losses. you're comfortable with the opportunity loss. You're comfortable with not building a legacy for your children. You're comfortable with all those things.
Right.
Because you didn't do the scary thing. You played it safe.
Sure. Are you so a mom did who's you just like making it through? Although some
yes, did yeah. you just do a lap where you were hand over handing around the edge of the swimming pool, just always hanging on? And it's like, and you got all the way
that's
around.
That's pretty good for a 4-year old.
Just that's what you did. And so when it comes to fear, it is interesting because so many dads and so many parents try to get their kids to face their fears and do not face their own. Mm. And their kids are facing these, you know, fictional fears, monster fears, little fears, fears of
jumping. Yeah. Trying to front
fears
foot.
Of playing baseball and striking out, fears of going up to the plate and the ball's coming. Sure. Like all these little things where they have to face their fears. What are you scared of, Dad? And why are you running? You know, yeah. It's like, why are you doing the exact opposite of what you're trying to teach your son to do? What are you scared of, Mom? You know, and it's, what are the fears? Where are the worries? Where are your temptations? What's your version of picking up that baseball bat and walking out to the plate, terrified of the pitcher?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and why aren't you doing it?
Okay, here's the thing I think plays into that. I wonder what you think. The idea of maturity, the idea of, hey, you arrived and you don't need to grow.
Yeah.
And I do think that may be part of our infantilization of our religion. Because the idea of like, yeah, you're an adult now, you've arrived, as opposed to, no, you're a 35-year-old, you know, on the low end, you have double. You're getting yeah. talents now that you'd better be paying off in 35 more yep. years. I don't know that we talk a lot about what growth is supposed to look like in the midlife. I think our vision right. is a lot of, do you have the driveway and the car and the truck that you want?
And then you tie the balloon off and it's done.
Right.
And right. you just kind of, then you start listening to Dave Ramsey and you pay off, you know, you sell the bass yeah. boat and you pay off your credit card slowly and you hand over hand on the edge of the swimming pool, mm-hmm. you know, and that's all.
Yeah. And our timeline is so truncated to get your kids happily through college, you know, or to, yeah. to college.
And I get it. I understand that.
Obviously,
trying to get your
kids. Not saying that's bad.
Yeah. But it is. I understand that could be this big weight. Like, this is what I'm trying to get to. My first will graduate from college in a couple of weeks and then another one next year and another one the year after that. And I'm already thrilled, you know, yeah, be like, right. it's here. It's almost here. But it is really interesting that we don't really face our fears in adulthood. And we, you know, we call it wisdom and, you know, we really, really carefully motor about without taking any big risks. And it's not to say we should all just be plunging into risks, but that's weird that we are so uncomfortable with failure. Yeah. So uncomfortable with failure in adulthood. You know, it's like, and there are, because there's consequences. You don't understand, there's consequences.
Did we not make our kids fail enough? That's the question I'm wondering. Like, did we not learn, or is it just the stakes feel real big when you're an adult?
I know there are, I firsthand could know that there's plenty of moms and dads, but especially moms, who really hustle to organize and discipline their kids' schedules and try to keep them on their homework because they do not want them to fail. Mm. They don't want to put it on them and have them have to come home and be like, "Welp, I bombed science." You know, it's like, and then you hold them to an expectation of like, "Well, honey, did you do your best?" You know, instead of, as long as it's your best, instead of saying, this is our expectation for you based on your abilities. And this is what you're going to need to do. And that's going to include them taking responsibility and owning their schedule and really possessing the burden of that failure. And then also the glory of the success. Yeah. You want it to be their success.
Right.
Right. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where people say you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, but
Michael Scott says that.
Yeah. A lot of people say that. It's true. But if you look at like, man, if I try this, what am I risking? Your risk reward. There's so many people who want to risk so, so, so little. And then when they have taken a risk, it eats them up. They get ulcers. It turns out that in adulthood, they still have all the anxiety and all of the worry of a little kid with thick glasses walking out to the plate to face somebody who throws the ball 75 miles an hour. Right. And they're still scared of the ball. They're still scared of standing in there.
Right, right.
And they, or they habituate failure and they become comfortable with that. And, you know, they do that in life as well.
Yeah.
But it's weird to me that we think, yeah, there's all these life lessons. And then as adults.
Yeah, you're not watching for the life lesson in the same way.
Yeah. You're not looking for it. And you're also not willing to take these bets. You know, it's like, if I think about all the things I've tried to do and how many of them have come up short or failed, it's like, I don't know. I have no idea what my batting average is. It's not good. You know, it's not good at all. Mm. And I have to be comfortable with every single thing that comes along in terms of investing time, investing money, investing effort with what do I think the risk profile is? And am I comfortable taking that loss? Am I comfortable with this whole thing goes away? And it turns out I burned all that time. And I burned all that money. I burned all that effort. And am I comfortable with my head up, turning around and walking away from the plate having struck out?
Yeah.
And so we want our kids to be brave. We want our kids to face monsters and face their fears so that they can become our age and not anymore do any of those things.
Right. Right. No, that's great. I mean, so to me, it seems like rather than watching a demon possession movie.
And we medicate for anxiety. No.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Rather than self-control for it.
Yep. Building up the muscles and facing fears.
Yeah, but that's tough.
Oh, yeah.
Anxiety doesn't just go away, Nate.
Oh, but it does.
Yeah, what is it? I think it's your mother that I heard the stress is a sin from.
Be anxious over nothing.
Right.
Except for all the things I'm anxious about, because you don't understand God. I don't know where the minivan payment is coming from.
Right.
Where will the manna be coming from tomorrow? Right. I don't know.
Yeah, that idea. Well, I'm just feeling a little, you tell your kids, I'm just stressed. And it's like, oh yeah, stress is sin. So.
Right.
I like that we put the just in there.
Yeah.
Just.
That's all. Just a little stressed.
But I was going to say though, instead of looking at the demon possession and being worried you're going to find a demon somewhere, feels more like we should be reading Flannery O'Connor and being afraid of finding ourselves in the Flannery main character. Yeah,
that is fair.
And that one feels where maybe that's some adult level
hypocrisy and self-destruction.
Some adult level fear comes from Flannery in a much better way than it does from The Exorcist or whatever.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think if you don't have legacy goals, what you're hoping to leave behind for your children, if you're just protecting your own existence, your present moment, and you don't have a destination on the horizon that you're laboring for and working towards, then I think that you're failing. You're failing sort of as a human. I don't think it has to be, it's not like you have to be trying to be a billionaire, but you have to be looking at what has God given me? What are my abilities? And what should I be leaving behind? How do I leave my kids way ahead? Like, how do I get them further ahead spiritually, economically, educationally? How do I let them walk over my back and get farther? How do I get them down the road and not just protect my current comfort level and my current existence, the way that the status quo functions in our household, and teach them lessons and get them to school and expect them to sort of take my place at this particular station? But how do I actually like lever and build? Moving forward. So how do I leave them far bigger, especially as dads? How do you leave all your sons bigger and better men than you in every single way?
Yeah.
Like in on every way that matters. So spiritually, emotionally, economically, like in every single category that matters, how do you get them further down the road than you were and that you are? That should be the goal. And that means facing your fears in adulthood as well. So, because we are all going to die. You're all going to have a death scene. We should work that into every single podcast. You all have a death scene and we're all going to face the death scene faithfully or unfaithfully, boldly or fearfully.
That's the alternate name of this podcast.
Death. You're all going to die.
You're all going to die.
You're all going to die, LLC. It's, we want to save all that for later. So face your fears. I think that's probably the biggest and best thing we can say is we all need to be facing our fears the way we want our kids to be facing our fears. But that means we face the things that scare us, not the things that scare them. They face the things that scare them, and we help them learn to do that. But we gotta march towards ours. Pick out the smooth stones and walk on down to face them.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff. All right. Do you have a lamp?
Oh, lamp. Do I?
You want to just grab one?
Do you have one? I thought we were doing this elsewhere. I thought we were going to start this. Didn't I just say that? The last thing, we're going to start a separate one. We're still going to do it here too.
Well, I mean, we got to let people know.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should wait.
We'll wait.
I want to make it the Godfather, but that's.
Why not? Are you just worried? Are you stressed about picking the Godfather?
You know, it's totally self-preservation. I'm just wondering if I'll be bored talking about it.
If we get bored of the Godfather, we'll just find something else. Or it's going to be a really short lamp.
A really short lamp. A really long movie for a really short.
Yeah. We'll just talk about Marlon Brando's jaw lip things that he wore.
Yeah. His jowl.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm leaning that direction because I'm watching The Offer with my kids, which is a great show. Filtered.
Filtered.
Filtered. Hashtag filtered. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I watched Slow Horses. Didn't love it.
Yeah.
But enjoying it a little bit at times.
There's things, there's moments, but not. Not
something
by
that's
it.
Worth. What's that? Did you ever watch Peanut Butter Falcon?
No.
No. Okay.
And it's one of those things that I've watched the trailer and enjoyed the trailer, and it does not close me on the 2 hours.
Sure.
So sure. I don't know. Yeah, we're gonna have to go with Lamp. I'm gonna have to think about it. We'll take suggestions. Let's do that.
Sure.
People send in suggestions, we'll mull, and I'll consider it a commitment that I will pick one.
Good.
I will pick one by the next podcast. So by next Monday.
Good.
Okay. We're out. Face your fears.
That's the life I want. I want to be 70 and have 18 grandchildren. Let's go.
I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand.
I'm Tucker Carlson, and I am here with the very famous and highly controversial Pastor Doug Wilson.
Even more controversial.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.